Hello and welcome to Studio P3. I'm sitting here with Jean-Jacques Van Vlasler and we're exploring the symphony. But today, as part of our series on the piano concerto, we're going to be looking at the Ravel Piano Concerto in G. Now, Jean-Jacques, I have to say that when I was in school, when I was a girl, I asked my harmony and dictation teacher, Monsieur Baron. I was a self-cultivated person. I didn't know anything about music. I just went from this to that. And I said, well, what should I listen to? I heard some Mozart. I heard some Beethoven. Where should I go? And he gave me a cassette the next day. And on one side was the Ravel concerto for the left hand. And the other side was the concerto in G. And I played that thing, oh my God. I played it and I had the two concertos confused, but what an extraordinary thing to have in your ears.
Yeah. But you got them confused because you were a young girl and you didn't know anything else because they're very different, obviously. You know.
However, he wrote them at the same time is what I understand.
He wrote them at the same time together. You know, two things at the same time, like some people have written in history two symphonies at the same time. You know, it's or two works which help them get rid a little bit of the other one. So Ravel played between two piano concertos, and I think playfulness is part very much of the Ravelian world. However, most probably we'll have to say when this man has lived and when this great French composer has lived, you know, 1875, 1937, he died quite young. He died of a brain tumor. And the last years he was very ill. From 1933 on, he was very ill and didn't compose important works. Thus, these two piano concertos are about the two last great works he composed. Yeah, these are the two last works he composed. After that, because the piano concertos are done between 1929 and 1931, and then he travels. He travels in Central Europe. He travels with the piano concertos, with Marguerite Long, who plays most of them and who had created the G major piano concerto. So this is that was really the end of his life. We'll get back to that.
So let's start at the beginning.
Ravel. If we say 1875, we think the zeitgeist is the fin de siècle. Here are three languages at the same time in one sentence. So the zeitgeist is fin de siècle. And he is, at the same time, very influenced and not influenceable. And I'm going to explain this. Very influenced because he's, what is happening at that time? The great Germans. I mean, you have Bruckner, you have Beethoven, Bruckner, Franz Liszt, Wagner. They're all around. So there is Central Europe is very present. Russia is very present, and he will be influenced by Glazunov, by Borodin, by Rimsky-Korsakov, by Mussorgsky. And we can see in which work he is influenced by Mussorgsky. Skarbo, for example, one of his piano works. Rimsky-Korsakov will influence his orchestration all over the place. Glazunov will influence his quartet. But not only Glazunov will influence his quartet, but at the same time, he is himself from the very first work on. So he takes in all these influences from Central Europe, from Russian music, but also from French music. You know, he's influenced by Massenet, and he says it himself. His teacher was Gabriel Fauré, and Gabriel Fauré will have a great influence on him, and perhaps we'll talk about that. Chabrier, you know, a composer which I think is a very good composer and who has been always sidelined, you know, again, by history, because he was sometimes too funny within his music. Erik Satie, Eric Satie has a very good influence also. Very interesting influence. And perhaps we'll talk about all these things. So who is this man? Who is this man? Oh, he's not a romantic, certainly. And he's very elusive. And this is the difficulty of our conversation now. He's elusive behind his different masks. As a human being. You know, he will thrill at symbolism, at impressionism, at cubism, at the Ballet Russe, the Russian ballet, which was very important at that time. And like Stravinsky and like many other composers, he will compose a major work for Diaghilev, who was the head of the Ballet Russe, which is called Daphnis and Chloe, and which is a major work within the repertoire of the Ballet Russe. So he will be influenced by poetry, by Mallarmé, by Henri de Régnier, which are important poets at that time. So there is this young, very gifted man. He will get Le Prix de Rome, which was an important thing at that time. He's a bit older. He's about 35 in 1905 when he gets it.
Will he really get the Prix de Rome, though?
In 1905, yes.
And to get the second Prix de Rome, what happens? The Grand Prix?
I don't know, because I'm not interested in prizes. So
right. No. Well, I was wondering, because you talk about this man. He was a very, very talented. And what I understand is that he presented himself at the Prix de Rome many times.
Many times, oh yes.
And so what I was wondering is not the prize, because I understand what you're saying. Medals and prizes for music, that's like Olympics for pianists, of course. However, did it hurt him inside?
Oh, it must have hurt him inside. It must have hurt him inside, because most of the composers were trying this out. So, you know, Debussy tried it out also.
Yes.
But and usually it were people, Berlioz has even tried it out, you know. Berlioz tried it out. And, you know, this was the thing to be done. But they usually went to more academic musicians, people that stayed within the realm of tradition, and not people that opened up like Debussy and Ravel. Now, very often Debussy and Ravel are looked at like parallel figures, but they're very extremely different, both of them. And I simply wanted to mention this.
Would you like to talk about? We're jumping around, but would you like to talk about his origins?
Yes,
Basque,
if you want to. He has a double origin, you see. He has his father is from the Swiss part of France. No, from the French part of Switzerland. So this is, and his mother is Basque. Now the Basque is partially, you know, this is a group, linguistic group, and also a cultural group that is situated both in France and in Spain. So he will be a real product of those two things. At one side, you have the Swiss precision of his music, and the other side, you have all this very different influence built on light and shadows, light and darkness. And so he, you know, in Scarbo you have darkness, but then most of those works are very works that have within them the light of the South.
Like the Bolero, I guess. Huh?
Like the Bolero also, but there are all other elements that enter in the Bolero, which I think perhaps we can talk about in a few seconds. So he loves formal perfection. And that's most probably Swiss side, you know, not his Mediterranean side, you know. He has a passionate imagination, a great imagination.
He's good at telling stories, apparently, eh?
Yes. And most of his works, and that's, you know, he tells stories within those works, like Daphnis and Chloe is a great example. What he pursues is what a critic called the aesthetics of the impossible. He pushes his technique so far, you know, most of his works he couldn't play himself as a pianist. And certainly he could not conduct them. He was a very bad conductor. Very bad conductor.
It doesn't always stop you from conducting.
By the way, this is very funny, because the premiere of the G major concerto, he conducted. And it was, and one has to have an extremely precise conductor to accompany the pianist and go with the pianist. So the aesthetics of the impossible. His thought process is essentially, how far can I push virtuosity? How far can I work out my technique? One of his works has a title which he got from the poet Henri de Régnier. And I'm translating this from French. The French says, le plaisir délicieux d'une occupation inutile. You know, the delicious pleasure of an unnecessary pursuit, an unnecessary profession, and that is about music. So very different of people like in the Germanic tradition, like Mahler, like Bruckner, like Beethoven, who want to speak about us, ourselves, to go into depth. For him, for Ravel, the depth is at the surface.
That's perfect. That's beautiful.
And so virtuosity, technique, the creation of a spell, of a hypnotic moment within music. That's what he was after, you know. Obsession, and he got that from Satie. Immobility within a musical work. He got that also from Satie. In his search for virtuosity, the study of crescendo. What can I do with the crescendo? And you mentioned the bolero. There you go. But it goes even much further. He tries to see how he can work out poverty in music, simplicity in music. I mean, he will do that in many of his works.
You have to elaborate on this.
Yes. I thought you would ask me. You know, harmonic poverty, for example, in some of his songs. Polyphonic poverty in his sonata for violin and violoncello.
What's the difference between poverty and simplicity?
Poverty is extreme simplicity.
Right, okay.
That's how I would call it.
So if your listeners right now want to hear examples of this,
You can listen to the sonata in duo about violin and violoncello for polyphonic simplicity, if you want it. Mm-hmm. Harmonic simplicity, the epitaph called Ronsard à son âme, which is a song, yes, by him. Or the richness of poverty, the richness of simplicity. You mentioned the bolero. There it is.
There it is. One rhythm, one chord.
16 bars. Yeah. And there you have melodic poverty. There's nothing more than that. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. No, you're right.
The monotone variety, which he puts into the Capriccio Espagnol, which of course is influenced by Rimsky-Korsakov. So monotone, melodic poverty, harmonic, polyphonic, and he just plays with all that. You know what he says about, you started our conversation by talking about the concerto for the left hand. He said, yeah, I'll show you what I can do with five fingers only.
Well, he wanted it to sound right. He wanted it to sound like as if it was 10 fingers, of course. He didn't want it to be deprived of color or sound or richness because there was one hand missing. And I swear, you listen to that and you don't always make the difference. It's fantastically. So you're talking about poverty and simplicity, and I'm going with you.
But he's playing
and he loved.
You remember the masks? The masks? And he's just playing.
And the toys, the storytelling.
Yes.
Apparently, he was a very small man, a little delicate man who loved to tell stories. He loved mechanical toys.
Absolutely.
Things like that. Was he a well-liked person?
By a certain number of people, yes. Yeah. By a certain number of people. But, I mean, I think he was also a hero. I mean, it's kind of, he has had, you know, you were talking about his size and his person as such. You know, during the First World War, he said, I want to go and fight. I want to go and fight. You know, 1914, 1918, I want to go and fight. And
he wanted to go they didn't want to the front,
yes. And they didn't want him. He was too small. I mean, and he was too old at that time. You know, 1914, you're 25, 39 years old. You know, what they need is cannon meat. That means 20-year-olds. Mm-hmm. But he got into the army as a driver for I think for a major officer, and he tried to get in. I think he tried to get into the army as an ambulance driver, but finally he ended up as a driver of a major officer because people knew him very well. He was a major composer, and there are very funny stories about that. You know, he had lots of humor, by the way, lots of humor, but it's acid humor. You know, acid humor. But he, at a given moment, he gets out of his car during, and this is an anecdote, and usually I don't tell anecdotes, but here is one. You know, he opens the door for the I don't know what the grade was of that general or major or colonel. He opens the door, and the colonel says to him, whoever it was, says to him, I should open the door for you. Wonderful story, of course. Wonderful story. But may I end that anecdote by something much more important. At the end of the war, what he writes is La Valse, the waltz. And in that waltz, for orchestra and also for piano, he has a version for piano, in that waltz, he kills the Viennese waltz. It's the waltz to kill all Viennese waltzes. It's the most extraordinary work. It explodes at the end.
Oh, it starts very simple, but at the end, the furniture is spinning.
It just grows and grows. And when we talk about crescendo, when we talk about, and it's the same melody coming back. You know, it's already a first version in a way of the bolero. But after that bolero, 1928, what does he do? He goes to the United States, has a wonderful trip, a long trip in the United States, comes back and is very impressed by that new world. You said he was very interested in mechanical things, in new things, he's very impressed by it, and that will influence the writing of his two piano concertos, because the two piano concertos will reflect the... It's not me saying this. This is a famous German critic who wrote about it, who was a very, very good critic. He said, the two concertos reflect the speed, the versatility, the turbulence of North America, and which had influenced very much the sensitive mind of Ravel and left on him a very profound impression. And so that's when he gets back home after that, 1929, and he says, okay, I'm going to compose those two piano concertos. And of course, it will be influenced by that kind of intensity of North America, but also by some jazz elements.
Did he meet Gershwin?
He met Gershwin, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and Gershwin said to him, there we go into another anecdote. You're pulling me into anecdotes today. I mean, and Gershwin said to him, can I take a few lessons from you? And Ravel turned around and said, I should take lessons from you. Because Ravel didn't make as much money then.
Right.
Gershwin did.
Right.
So
well,
it's a famous
story.
So
you're describing a lovely, gentle man with courage.
And a very refined gentleman, yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about the concerto.
Yes.
I saw on YouTube Bernstein conducting and playing this concerto. So it was done quite a bit to play and conduct from the piano.
Yeah.
Not an easy feat.
It's not an easy feat. No, it's not an easy feat because it's a very demanding piano concerto, and you know the play between the orchestra and the piano.
Well, right at the opening, and not yeah, to absolutely. not to go too much into this, but you know, we've talked about other composers for piano concertos. Now, this, the way it starts, the way it is, the way the piano and the orchestra work together, there's a whip in there. There's all sorts of percussions in there, weird solos from the winds. What's that all about? That's a different kind of concerto. Who's the most important here, the orchestra or the piano, or are they knit very tightly together? What was his goal?
The third option.
Yeah, the knitting option. Knit
very tightly together. I remember what Bernstein said about something totally different, but about concertos. He said, sometimes it's the soloists running the game, sometimes it's the conductor is running the game. So let's talk about that piano concerto very quickly and see what's in that piano concerto. So he composes the two piano concertos at the same time. And on one side you have the left hand, the four, five fingers, which resemble 400 fingers, you know, an ornamental piano concerto, almost a grandiose piano concerto. And in all points, it's opposed to that G major piano concerto that you have, that we're talking about. The left hand is in one movement, but within that one movement, you have three movements. They're all tied, they're flowing into each other. On the other hand, you have three very neatly different movements for the G major. And it starts in the very high regions, in the very beginning, both in the orchestra and within the piano. And we said a few words about light. It's luminous, it's light, it's limpid. And that's how the piano concerto starts. So the other one starts in darkness, and this one starts in light. And you see, there you have those two parts of Ravel. And then, of course, there is a concertante, you mentioned it already, between the two elements, the two of them. And then it flows into a kind of lively song, almost a popular song, and the rhythm is a happy-going one. You know, you have pizzicatos of the violins and the alti, tremolos of the cellos, and an impalpable rolling of the drums. You know, and the piano talks, telling a story. Talks in arpeggios, bubbling over with arpeggios. You know. But there is also some, and you mentioned it also, some aggressive atmosphere in there. You know, there are notes in there that you say to yourself, where do they belong? You know, and there is bitonality in it, some elements are syncopated rhythm, some close to the jazz, you know. And at the end, you know, the piano has the last words and finishes in oriental mode. Aha, the Basque part, yeah. In almost a canto flamenco at the end of the first movement. Second movement again. Before, we have been talking about the fourth piano concerto by Beethoven, here too. In this Ravel concerto, you have an extraordinary, wonderful, singing, poetic, slow movement.
And very, as you said, very simple.
And very simple. It's a kind of chant, a kind of recitative, you know, delicately fluid, moving within the work. And then, you know, it's like the expression of a remote dream. Can I say something about Ravel about that? And I think it's important. It is that Ravel's music was there to try to run away from life. I do think, and that is an extraordinary moment, not only the spellbinding, the moments of immobility within his music, but also this dreamlike second movement of the G major. Ravel tried to get music was that also. Now, everything I have said about technique and virtuosity was there just to run away, to get lost. And when it's well played, that's what you get in that second movement.
But you say it's a dream, but it makes me so sad. Every time I listen to it, it brings tears every time to my eyes. Yeah, nostalgic and sad.
That's because you're a very sensitive person, Marjolaine. And I will tell you, it makes me sad too.
Yeah?
Yes, you're not alone.
Yeah.
You're not alone. So
it sounds very nostalgic to me and not so much dreamy.
Luckily, there is the third movement.
True.
Which is a great dramatic tension, you know. He throws himself into it and it's fire, it's arduous, and it goes to, you know, it's victorious.
Isn't it
victorious.
A little cruel? The way that he just goes from this mood he's created, and here I am wiping little tears in the corners of my eyes, and boom! Why did he do this to us?
But life is cruel.
Oh, Jean-Jacques, that's very true. That's very true. So this man, again...
In a way, Ravel says so much about us, too.
Yes.
And so much about the 20th century, too. But without... pushing it. It's all there. Perfect music. Limpid music. Dark and light. And that's what life is about.
And there's nothing much to say about him besides, right?
He's there's not very,
very
much to say.
Quiet man.
That's right. He has ran his own life. A quite shy person.
And he ended his life in this lovely house that he bought with some cats and maybe some birds and little mechanical toys.
Yes. Yes, and unfortunately, very sad ending, of course, the four last years.
Did he even know exactly what was going on? He just couldn't write anymore.
He couldn't write anymore. The operations broke his, made it impossible for him sometimes to think very clearly.
Oh, dear.
And I know this illness well because there has been one in my family of many years ago, and it's terrible. It is terrible, tumor in the brain, you know. And especially at that time, one could not operate as well as one does today.
You were talking about Mussorgsky and the way he was inspired by Mussorgsky, but didn't he orchestrate Mussorgsky?
Of course he orchestrated
so
Mussorgsky.
So he took and he gave.
He took and he gave. He liked Mussorgsky so much. And what he did, in a way, he enlightened Mussorgsky with his orchestration.
And Mussorgsky accepted this?
Mussorgsky didn't know about it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Mussorgsky was dead a long,
long
time ago.
Time dead.
He had drank himself into pieces. So that, he was gone.
Well, let's remember the genius of the light and the dark, the shadows and light of Ravel.
And the man of many masks.
Thanks again, Jean-Jacques. I'm looking forward to talking to you again.
So do I.